It seems that in every area of oncology, clinical research on novel biologic agents and molecular predictors of response dominate the investigative landscape, and I met with Dr. John Crown to get his take on some of the key recent data sets, but we began our conversation by commenting on a paper presented at the last ASCO meeting and discussed by Dr. Crown, focusing on adjuvant chemotherapy.
I had the privilege of discussing a study conducted by our British colleagues and reported by Dr. Chris Poole, which looked at the possible role of gemcitabine as an addition to AC paclitaxel chemotherapy for patients with breast cancer. And there was a very good rationale for this. Gemcitabine in a large randomized trial had been shown to add to the therapeutic efficacy of paclitaxel in patients with metastatic disease. And following the kind of traditional approach which we always have had, it made sense to get it into an adjuvant trial. It was a large study, a well-conducted study, a well-balanced study done by very expert people, but the study was negative. There was no benefit either in disease-free or in overall survival for the addition of gemcitabine to a classic AC paclitaxel three-weekly regimen.
And I guess there's the NSABP B38 trial that's cooking out there that we don't have results on, and one of the arms there is similar, it's just that it's dose dense.
That is correct. And I think, in truth, I've developed a certain perspective on this over the last while, but my sense is that perhaps we should not be reiterating the mistakes we made with doxorubicin and doing endless numbers of large adjuvant trials with gemcitabine if we appear to have an answer from those two studies. I do think that when all we had was chemotherapy, doing large, multi-thousand patient, international, multi-million dollar randomized trials was the right thing to do. But now in the molecular era, I think we need to learn a different focus and a different way of doing adjuvant trials.
So I guess we should point out the NSABP trial has not reported yet.
That is correct.
They've got TAC versus dose-dense AC paclitaxel versus dose-dense AC paclitaxel GEM.
Well, Neil, there's a part of me that hopes that this will, to an extent, close a chapter in the history of breast cancer treatment, that I think there is now general agreement that the taxane regimens have represented a real advance over the older non-taxane regimens. There are several of them which I think have stood the test of time and have, in large, muscular, well-controlled randomized trials, shown advantages. One of them is TAC. One of them is AC dose-dense paclitaxel, and now there's been some interest in the newer AC weekly paclitaxel regimen after the ECOG study. My own gut feeling is that these regimens are all going to be probably pretty much the same, and I certainly don't think there's going to be a great return on the investment for the oncology community in doing many more large trials trying to nuance these differences.
I guess a couple other taxane regimens that are out on the table. One is the docetaxel cyclophosphamide TC regimen, U.S. Oncology, Steve Jones. And the other is nab-paclitaxel. What are your thoughts about those two approaches?
Well, I have very strong thoughts on the TC regimen. I think that was an excellent study. It was originally conceived to see if we could omit anthracycline. And boy, history is caught up with that one because of the controversy, which the listeners will be aware of, concerning the possibility that we have been overselling anthracycline, as it were, over the years, both in HER2-positive and in HER2-negative patients. As a result, I think the results of the study looking at TC versus TAC will be awaited with great interest. There are very good data which have been presented by my friend and colleague Dr. Slayman from the BCIRG dataset, which strongly suggest that patients who are HER2-negative are pretty much inevitably, invariably, topoisomerase-2-negative. And as we know, topo-2 is one of the principal targets for anthracycline. This, together with the recent meta-analysis data from Janarian colleagues presented in the JNCI, which strongly suggests that the benefit, that fairly weak benefit that we have seen over the years for anthracycline-containing versus non-anthracycline-containing regimens in the adjuvant treatment of breast cancer may be confined to the HER2-positive subset. And we would hypothesize, furthermore, that it is confined to the topo-2-positive subset.
In terms of HER2-negative breast cancer, any other nuances out there in terms of chemo that you think might be looking at more in trials?
Well, I mean, the real controversy right now for the HER2-negative patients is, are we going to adopt the data from the Janari overview and extrapolate from the BCIRG data set, which Dr. Slayman and Dr. Mike Press have worked on, and actually decide that, well, we're looking at regimens other than anthracyclines in the future? And I think the regimen which perhaps is taken quite a bit of attention has been the TC docetaxel cyclophosphamide regimen. I can just give you a personal perspective on that. Having gone through a lot of soul-searching and heart-searching on this, I have largely moved to a non-anthracycline standard now for these patients. There have been a few factors involved in that. One was this really repeated observation that if you are HER2 negative, it is hard to know exactly what benefit you are offering the patients in return for the toxicity. And as well as that, the increasing realization that the toxicity is maybe a little worse than we thought, that there are a couple of long-term risks with anthracycline. They're not great big public health crises, but they are there if you look for them, a drop-off in cardiac ejection fraction, and also rather alarming report that there may be as much as a 1% incidence of leukemia and myelodysplastic syndrome in patients who get more aggressive anthracycline regimens. So I have been giving a lot of TC, I have to tell you.
I think in a weird way, it kind of reminds me of what goes on with the AIs in that, you know, whether or not there's an advantage in terms of efficacy, there's definitely something that people value in terms of, you know, lack of endometrial cancer, deep vein thrombosis. And here, you know, I don't know quality of life why, whether these non-anthracycline regimens are much different, but again, the sort of long-term, rare but important events that you avoid. Does that seem like an analogy to you?
I must say, I think you're correct. I think that there are some side effects that perhaps frequently male doctors are insufficiently sensitive to in our female breast cancer patients. And we tend to perhaps somehow to not take some of these concerns seriously. I've always been shocked at how people could sit there and listen to you give them a very frightening lecture about all the possible side effects of the chemotherapy you were going to give them. And then when you would say to them, and at the end of it, you're going to take tamoxifen. And they'd say, oh, I won't take that. The number of patients who had a real fear in their hearts about the side effects of tamoxifen, and in particular, as you point out, the incidence of a second cancer, rare as it is, treatable as it usually is, curable as it usually is, there is a real terror associated with that in many people's minds.
Any other approaches out there before we start talking about biologic approaches? Any others that interest you or you think may have potential for the future?
Well, I can tell you that in the Irish Clinical Oncology Research Group, we have decided to launch a new generation of studies for our HER2-negative patients, and we will be enrolling patients soon on a large-scale adjuvant pilot trial of docetaxel cyclophosphamide with bevacizumab. And it is our hope that, I know there are others who are piloting similar regimens, and it is our hope that there will be a randomized trial looking at perhaps a non-anthracycline approach to these patients based on the question of a molecular therapeutic.
Well, I guess it looks like the NSABP now is about to hook up with U.S. Oncology to deal with that specifically, because the TIC-TAC study, which is TC versus TAC essentially, seems like it's now going to be expanded to a 2x2 with a third arm being exactly what you just talked about, TC plus Bev.
Well, I'd be very supportive of that trial, and I'd eagerly await the data on both the anthracycline versus no anthracycline question and on the bevacizumab question.
In terms of the HER2-positive population, I guess the argument that's evolved out of BCRG-006 is that you get pretty much the same efficacy without the anthracycline, specifically the TCH regimen, with a lot less risk to the heart. Is that your take, and what are you doing in your own practice?
Well, I am the joint chairman of that study with Dr. Slaman, so I perhaps am not the most unbiased observer, but I would tell you that in my own practice, I have stopped giving anthracycline and Herceptin-containing regimens. I have great difficulty with that, with the notion of co-administering those drugs, and I give TCH routinely as my adjuvant HER2-positive regimen.
Another regimen that we're hearing about that is also being looked at is the other TCH instead of carboplatin cyclophosphamide, essentially the U.S. Oncology TC plus trastuzumab. Any thoughts about that?
There would not be at this point in time the same quality of data for it. I mean, the BCIRG-006 trial was a 3,100-patient large international trial. It accrued briskly, was monitored aggressively. The data are very clean. It has given, I believe, very clear answers, which have generated a certain amount of controversy and which, I agree, require individual interpretation. But in the adjuvant world, I think we'd be a little bit slow to go moving to unvalidated regimens.
I guess one of the biggest controversies that's come out of the entire adjuvant trastuzumab data set has been the patient with HER2-positive tumor that's node negative and small, particularly under a centimeter. What are your thoughts about that in terms of what we know about the prognosis of these patients without trastuzumab and with it?
I'm not going to make a blanket recommendation on that one, Neil, but obviously there is a sort of a resonance here from the kind of argument we had before with node-negative therapeutic choices in the premolecular era. We know that we can affect a substantial proportional risk reduction with our treatments. And with a good chemotherapy plus Herceptin regimen, the degree of risk reduction we get is colossal. And it all really hinges on what the baseline risk is. And individual physicians have to make up their own mind if they think that the relatively small apparently relatively small risks of serious life-threatening side effects with TCH therapy, you know, well-managed, well-monitored, well-supported TCH therapy, are justifiable in patients whose prognosis is that bit smaller.
So specifically, is there sort of a lower limit where you generally don't treat patients?
Well, my philosophy, I think I would perhaps invert the question. I will always make a gentle recommendation in favor of treatment for somebody whose tumor is more than 1 centimeter, who's node negative and HER2 positive. And below that, we have a talk. We go through some of the arithmetic. We get a little sense for what the person's personal perspective is. We also would factor in things like receptor status, grade, lymphovascular invasion, all of these other findings. I would not that often treat patients under a centimeter with chemotherapy plus Herceptin regimen.
Do you buy into Peter Rabdin's general concept of multiplying the risk in general that we think about, the risk that might get generated at his model, for example, times 1.5 is a ballpark way to get a number on this? Or do we know really what the numbers are under a centimeter?
I don't think we know specifically what the numbers are under a centimeter, but we know that in general there is a multiplier if you're HER2 positive as opposed to being HER2 unselected. And I guess as a result, some people might say 7 millimeters, 8 millimeters, yes. Again, I don't want to make a blanket recommendation on that. I think this is exactly in the area where doctors need to sit down with their patient and go through the risks and the benefits and have a little think about it.
In that situation, or any situation, let's say you've suggested or recommended TCH to a patient, they turn around and say to you, well, I've been reading about the issue of the heart and trastuzumab. By my, let's say, healthy 55-year-old woman, no hypertension, nothing, just normal cardiovascular function, says to you, will my risk of having a cardiac problem increase by taking TCH? And if so, how much? How do you answer it?
The best evidence is probably yes, but by a tiny amount. If you have never been exposed to anthracycline, and if you get Herceptin with a non-anthracycline-containing regimen, in our study, the occurrence of serious cardiac dysfunction was extremely low. It was under 0.5%. And I can tell you that many of our patients, it got better. I believe that the lesion which Herceptin, in the absence of anthracycline, causes on the heart is different to the lesion which anthracycline causes on the heart, which tends to be a long-lasting lesion.
And how do you respond to that same question? 60, 65-year-old woman, been treated for hypertension for 10 years successfully. Same answer or a little bit higher?
Again, it depends on the risk of her cancer. But
I'm talking about risk of the heart disease with TCH.
Well, what I would say to her is, except if she had an extraordinarily low-risk cancer, the benefit of getting TCH therapy is likely to considerably overweigh the risk to her heart. I mean, there is a slightly higher risk. There's no doubt about it. But if you don't give anthracycline, you seldom see serious cardiac toxicity.
Let's talk about some of the new approaches in terms of biologic strategies for breast cancer, because I hear you, and I think a lot of people are having similar thoughts to what you verbalized about, you know, it's time to start looking for something a little bit better. Let's start out with HER2-positive diseases. To me, it seems like that's where a lot of the excitement has been. You've been involved in the work looking at lapatinib, the New England Journal paper, the first study looking at capecitabine and lapatinib, and then a subsequent analysis. They really started to dissect out what's going on in that study. What's your overall take about lapatinib? Can you talk a little bit about the mechanism of action and what was seen in this trial?
I think this is a really fascinating drug, and it may somehow seem to the outside observer that oncology is relentlessly focusing on the HER2 subset of breast cancer patients, but there's a good reason for it. Because of the headlining work which Dr. Slaman did in the 1980s, we have a better understanding, I think, of that system than we have of many other systems. We've longer experience with it, and it's been a target for therapeutic intervention. Lapatinib interests me for several reasons. The main thing that interests me about lapatinib is the possibility that a combined lapatinib and Herceptin blockade or attack, as it were, may produce superior results compared to either individual molecularly targeted agent alone. And there have been several lab groups which have shown that there is apparently an additivity or even a synergy between these two drugs in HER2-positive cell lines. And in fact, there was a trial presented at ASCO this year which suggested that this may in fact be also applicable to the clinic, which I think is very exciting, and it's very good news for the whole question of trying to do adjuvant trials with lapatinib and Herceptin. I would hope that we will see a broader portfolio of such studies becoming available. One is being inaugurated. The readers will know the ALTO trial. And at this point in time, lapatinib does offer another treatment for our patients with Herceptin-failed metastatic breast cancer, which is HER2-positive, patients that have been extraordinarily heavily pretreated, it does offer them a prospect for further meaningful benefit, which is always worthwhile in the palliative setting. But again, Neil, my real hope is that it will give us an opportunity, together with Herceptin, to produce better results. Interestingly, the benefit appears to be wholly confined to patients with HER2-positive breast cancer. If there is activity in patients who are HER2-negative, it is very, very minimal, which is, I guess, perhaps it would have been a surprising outcome from 4 or 5 years ago when the drug was first being initiated into trials because of its dual action on EGFR and on HER2. While there may be an interplay between these two receptors, which accounts for some of lapatinib's activity, using it to target HER2-negative tumors by virtue of a targeting effect on EGFR does not appear to be a very productive strategy at the moment.
At least in metastatic disease, which is the case for trastuzumab, but now there's some discussion and interest in maybe the adjuvant setting being different, a la Soon Paik and his work in the HER2-low patients.
Well, again, I think that body of work is extremely provocative, and I know that many of the very serious HER2 biologists in the field are looking at it very critically and would like to see some amplification of those results.
Yeah, that was fascinating. So getting back to lapatinib, it is a TKI that does target EGFR as well as HER2. What do we know about, in the HER2-positive tumors, the contribution, if any, of the anti-EGFR effect?
Well, we don't know for definite, but there's certainly a speculation that an interplay between the two systems may perhaps account for some of the benefit which lapatinib exerts. Of course, lapatinib would work in a fundamentally different way. It would work more on the intracellular side rather than Herceptin. So there are a number of different downstream regulators of HER2 which may perhaps be differentially affected by lapatinib as opposed to by Herceptin. This is an area of really intense investigation at the moment. And all I would say is watch this space.
Specifically, in terms of EGFR, is there any particular mechanism that could be involved that in some way is, you know, helping out?
It's possible that there's a dimerization effect between EGFR and HER2, which may be partly contributing to the benefit of lapatinib. That's one of the speculations, yeah.
What about the side effects of lapatinib? You actually are part of a paper looking at diarrhea, an overview of diarrhea and lapatinib, which I thought was really interesting. Can you kind of talk about what we know about the side effects?
Lapatinib, in general, is a well-tolerated drug. Most patients who are on lapatinib will be aware they're on lapatinib, in a sense that perhaps patients on Herceptin will not, other than attending for visits. Skin rash, a mild level of skin rash can occur. A little bit of diarrhea is relatively common. Severe diarrhea is not common. It can occur. It needs to be managed aggressively, and if it is managed aggressively, it will be successfully treated. Of course, one of the issues with lapatinib is that in its current indication, it has really been used with capecitabine, and the combination of those two drugs, of course, can cause diarrhea. On its own, in the absence of being co-administered with a diarrhea-inducing chemotherapy agent, diarrhea is less of a problem.
So when you start a patient on capecitabine and lapatinib, what are some of the things that you tell them to do or to call you about?
In my jurisdiction, in Ireland, lapatinib use is confined to a specific indication, which is co-administered with capecitabine in patients with HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer whose disease has progressed following anthracyclines, taxanes, and trastuzumab. So these poor ladies are usually in a degree of difficulty. They've been heavily pretreated and they have bad cancer. So they need to be handled very carefully. They need to be very attuned to the possibility of side effects. And of course, I warn them particularly about diarrhea. And the first advice to give them if they're at home and they're getting bad diarrhea is, of course, stop the tablets and get in touch with us. And depending on where they are in their capecitabine cycle, we will make recommendations on dose reduction, often of the capecitabine in truth, and we will give them antidiarrheals as needed. I don't believe I've personally seen a patient coming in with life-threatening diarrhea. It certainly is reported, and clinicians need to be aware of that possibility.
What about the rash? Any sort of pearls about how to manage it or what to do with it?
Again, the question with the rash, you have to treat it as you would any EGFR rash and generally stop the treatment for a few days, let it settle down. Some patients will actually need specific interventions or antibiotics. For many patients, it'll just be a question of reinstituting the drug at a lower dose. Another side effect which actually caused a little hiccup with lapatinib over the last month or two was an uncommon occurrence of severe liver toxicity.
Yeah, I heard about that.
It really is distinctly uncommon. And of course, in a population of patients who are getting so many other treatments and who have metastatic disease and who are unwell for so many reasons, it can be hard to winkle out exactly what was being caused by lapatinib. But it certainly caused a delay in the submission in Europe for the drug to be registered and a rewording of the information leaflet, just so that people were aware that it was there. But it is uncommon.
What, reversible transaminase?
Yes, usually. but it has occasionally been very severe.
You mentioned the strategy of combining trastuzumab and lapatinib in the paper at ASCO, which I guess you're referring to the one by Joyce O'Shaughnessy looking at the combination. Can you talk a little bit more about what your take was on that and sort of where you think that might be heading? Do you think there's any role outside of a protocol setting for that kind of a strategy right now, any situation, if you can get it paid for?
Well, again, perhaps our circumstances in Europe are a little bit different to here. I would not be advocating the routine co-administration of lapatinib and Herceptin outside of the context of a trial, but I can tell you there are real good reasons for believing it's something which we need to get to the bottom of. And if there definitely is clinical benefit confirmed, that it would be, in fact, a recommended treatment. At this point in time, I could not recommend it.
What do we know about the combination of lapatinib with other chemotherapeutic agents other than capecitabine, for example, Taxol, in terms of side effects, efficacy, et cetera?
Lapatinib has been studied with taxanes. And of course, there is an occurrence of diarrhea and skin rash. The taxanes can cause both of those drugs in their own right. So a certain amount of caution needs to be exercised there. We're actually doing a trial led by the Irish Clinical Oncology Research Group looking at docetaxel, lapatinib, and trastuzumab. We're very keen to try and get a good backbone of a taxane plus dual HER2 antagonist trial in the absence of anthracycline therapy. Interestingly, we're also doing a trial of epirubicin plus lapatinib. Another interesting approach that we're investigating, and I stress this is an investigative approach, is looking at epirubicin together with lapatinib. Lapatinib is an interesting little molecule. As well as its EGFR and HER2 antagonism, it's also a substrate for the multi-drug resistance P glycoprotein, and as such could be used as a mechanism for modulating resistance to natural chemotherapy drugs like anthracyclines, which is mediated through these resistance pumps, these transmembrane energy-requiring pumps, which were very much in vogue investigationally 10 to 15 years ago, and which have kind of, I guess, dropped down a little bit from the investigative radar. As well as that, lapatinib would appear to be less cardiotoxic. Okay? So here's a little theoretical construct. If within the HER2-positive subgroup of patients, there are patients who are TOPO2-positive, and we know from the BCIRG work of Dr. Mike Press that about one-third of them are TOPO2 overexpressing. Is it possible that there is a subgroup of HER2 patients who might actually benefit from dual molecular targeting with an anthracycline and with a HER2 antagonist? Now, obviously, giving anthracycline, and this has been controversial, I personally do not favor giving anthracyclines and Herceptin. I think while some brave souls have conducted trials looking at that approach, I have great difficulty with it.
I'm thinking about Amon Buzdar's neoadjuvant.
Yes,
program,
and you know, and the truth is that in many of these trials, they do not see a strong signal of cardiotoxicity, and it may well be that with a limited number of anthracycline courses in a small trial, you won't. However, the danger from that approach is that people will then start extrapolating it to other regimens and to larger populations of patients, and especially to early-stage patients, and I think there's a real risk that we will start hurting some people's hearts there. But in theory, if there was a subpopulation of HER2 positives who were TOPO2 positive and who might benefit from an anthracycline and from HER2 antagonism, it might make sense to look at giving them an anthracycline and perhaps a less cardiotoxic HER2 antagonist. And that's why we're studying the combination of epirubicin and lapatinib. That plus the drug resistance modulation potential for lapatinib.
Interesting. In the docetaxel lapatinib trastuzumab study, what's the dose and schedule of docetaxel?
That is a standard 3-weekly schedule, and it's a dose escalation trial where we're looking at sequential cohorts of docetaxel, 60, 75, 85, and 100.
What's your take in terms of lapatinib in the brain and the issue of, are we seeing now patients escape adjuvant trastuzumab because of brain mets?
Well, Neil, there is no doubt that lapatinib is a better penetrator of the blood-brain barrier than Herceptin is. And in our large randomized trial of capecitabine plus lapatinib versus capecitabine, the percentage of patients who progressed with brain metastasis was statistically significantly lower in the lapatinib-containing regimen. I think it's another one of the very interesting and possible benefits for this drug, and one of the key things which adjuvant trials, I think, will be looking at very carefully. I do hope we get a good portfolio of adjuvant lapatinib and Herceptin trials.
And of course, the whole concept of combination of lapatinib and trastuzumab is being, as you mentioned, looked at in the adjuvant setting in the so-called ALTO trial.
It is, yes. And, you know, the science behind ALTO is first rate. I mean, I think the notion of giving conventional chemotherapy with combinations of HER2 antagonists is very reasonable. There is a little wariness earlier on about having some patients getting in lapatinib alone arm without Herceptin. I think with the benefit that have been seen from the lapatinib adjuvant study, there will be a somewhat greater comfort zone about that. My one little concern there is I wish that the ALTO investigators, the ALTO study leadership, had allowed non-anthracycline-containing regimens for the benefit of those investigators who are uncomfortable with giving regimens which contain anthracyclines and Herceptin.
That would include you, I guess.
It would include me.
Are you putting patients on the study?
I have made a decision not to become involved in ALTO for that reason. We instead are going to join the BCIRG and NSABP BETH trial, which is looking, I think, at another also very valid, very scientifically valid hypothesis, which is that there might be a clinically exploitable interaction between the HER2 and angiogenesis systems. Work from Dr. Sleiman and Dr. Pegram in patients with metastatic disease had shown quite prominent activity for the combination of trastuzumab and bevacizumab, and I think there is a real interest in looking at those in the adjuvant setting.
Can you talk a little bit more about the science behind that and what we know about HER2-positive disease and VEGF?
Yes, well, there have been studies done at a couple of different levels. There clearly has been a demonstration in preclinical systems that therapy with bevacizumab and trastuzumab appears to have a more than additive and probably synergistic effect in terms of inhibiting angiogenesis. As well as that, there have been data where Dr. Konechny from UCLA has studied one of the European adjuvant trials and has stratified patients, their outcome according to biological variables. And there does seem to be great prediction for the combination of having HER2 positivity and VEGF overexpression in terms of having an adverse prognostic impact.
What about safety issues in the BETH trial? I guess there's people are taking a real good look at the heart in terms of the issue combining Bev and trastuzumab. What's your take on that?
Well, I think the issue that they need to look at is the combination of Bev and trastuzumab and anthracycline, because all of the concerns we articulated earlier about giving anthracyclines together with trastuzumab, I think, become somewhat amplified when you look at the possibility that bevacizumab may well put an extra stress on that system. Now, the BETH trial had a long gestation for this reason. There was an intense discussion about what kind of chemotherapy backbone we should put into the BETH trial. And there is a sort of a dealer's choice option in that, but I believe most investigators are going to go for the classic BCIRG 006 TCH chemotherapy backbone with or without bevacizumab in the conduct of that trial.
Well, in fact, in North America, that's what it is. There is no option in terms of the NSABP and the CIRG. I think there is an option in certain centers, I guess.
Yes, let me respond to that.
Okay.
I'm delighted that our North American colleagues will be following the TCH version of the study. I think it is probably going to be safer, and it makes a lot of sense to me. It's what I'm doing.
In terms of the issue of combining docetaxel and bevacizumab, we have the Avado trial that was presented at ASCO. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Bevacizumab is potentially, I guess, the health economist's worst nightmare. It seems to be a drug which is going to work a little bit in a lot of cancers and work well enough to make it worth giving to many patients. Certainly, we now have two positive studies for bevacizumab with taxane therapy in metastatic breast cancer. The American study using paclitaxel and now the Avado trial using docetaxel. It is, I think, a little bit hard to escape the conclusion that bevacizumab adds something to the treatment of taxane therapy in patients with metastatic breast cancer. Now, others will have to get their heads around the question of whether that benefit is large enough to justify routine use of it in every jurisdiction, especially in jurisdictions where there are greater constraints on the use of drugs than may be the case in the U.S.
Interesting, you know, if you just sort of put aside the economic issue totally, let's imagine it was free or whatever, and you just look at the risk-benefit without bringing in the financial issue, it looks a lot different, don't you think?
Well, at present, I am giving bevacizumab with taxane therapy to my patients who have an indication for taxane therapy. I mean, selectively, I will discuss it with them, but it is something I'm frequently using.
And what's your experience with it in terms of side effects, toxicity, tolerability?
Bevacizumab, for the great majority of patients, it's a bit like trastuzumab. Patients don't know they're on it. I mean, they are not experiencing. I mean, we monitor the proteinuria. We do have to put some patients on antihypertensives when they're on it. In this population of patients, bleeding is not a prominent problem. These tend to be patients who are not having issues with wound breakdown. They're a different group of patients to some of the other indications where it has been used.
I want to get your take on what's going on in terms of ER-positive breast cancer. But first, any thoughts in terms of triple negative? Any sort of new ideas or thoughts there from a research perspective that, you know, maybe might be useful in the future?
Triple negative breast cancer has really assumed a fairly near dominant role on the investigative landscape right now. There is huge interest in this previously somewhat neglected group of breast cancer patients. I think the first thing to say is that patients that get triple negative breast cancer, especially informed patients who start doing literature searches, etc., often develop a total terror that they somehow have some totally untreatable and incurable form of cancer. And of course, that's not true. The majority of patients with early stage triple negative breast cancer, while their prognosis is somewhat worse than those who are not triple negative, they still have the same prospects for cure and long-term survival. I think that level of reassurance must be given to them.
That's interesting. So you're seeing that in your patients, they go out
Absolutely.
On the web and they get scared.
They are coming in saying, oh my God, I have triple negative breast cancer, I'm doomed. Hmm. You know, somebody with a 1.3 centimeter node negative cancer suddenly reckons that their whole future is darkened overnight. And they need a good degree of reassurance about this. I think at this stage with triple negative breast cancer, there are far more questions than answers. Obviously, there's interest now in the notion from the chemotherapy point of view that the platinums may have a specific activity there. That is the subject now of several large international randomized trials, one of which the Bally trial we're participating in Ireland, and it is looking at chemotherapy. There is obviously interest in platinum-containing chemotherapy in this setting, and it's the subject of a number of randomized trials. As well as that, there's great interest in EGFR antagonists in triple-negative breast cancer.
Although that's so far, I haven't seen anything that encouraging of you.
No, but there are ongoing trials, and you know we will see what the data are, and we have some large randomized trials. And some of the molecular agents, of course, are also being looked at. There is an adjuvant study starting already looking at Avastin.
That's the Beatrice study?
That's Beatrice.
That's what, dealer's choice chemo plus or minus
Avastin. And, other drugs are being looked at and other combinations. So I think in the next year or two, you will see a lot of translation of some of the regimens which are being developed preclinically into various clinical trials.
I guess, you know, you talk about in the past, but it really seems like people only recently really start to think about triple negative breast cancer as a separate subset. I mean, just in the last few years, you know, one of the things I think it might be interesting about efforts like Beatrice, where you're consolidating these people together, is maybe looking at translational issues.
I think that is the future, Neil. I think you've just knocked on the door of the, I'm mixing my metaphors horribly here, but of what we need to really be looking at in the future. And I think the great big lesson that we learned from all of the adjuvant chemotherapy trials, there's a story here, Neil. The story is that in the molecular era, we cannot develop molecular drugs the way we developed blunderbuss chemotherapy drugs in the pre-molecular era. It makes no sense. And I always, it's not just me, people have frequently commented on this. If you look at a drug like Iressa in lung cancer, where in the original randomized trials, following the early ballyhoo of activity for the drug in lung cancer, that there was this palpable sense of devastation when the trials were negative. And the reason was that an attempt was made to take a highly elegant molecularly targeted treatment and to use it in a non-molecularly selected population of patients. We possibly could have killed Herceptin if we had done it the same
Absolutely.
Way.
Absolutely.
You know, possibly could have. And now we know from wonderful work done post hoc that there is in fact a molecular phenotype of patients who do very well with Iressa therapy in lung cancer. And I think we need going forward to inextricably link the clinical and laboratory efforts into a seamless translational enterprise if we're actually going to develop these drugs appropriately. There's another big point to be made here, Neil. It took us approximately 20 years, 11 large randomized trials, 15,000 patients, and several meta-analyses to get to the bottom of a role for anthracyclines in the adjuvant treatment of breast cancer. And two things happened. Number one, we only had anthracyclines to develop during those 20 years. There really wasn't anything else, so we could make all this effort. And number two, as soon as we discovered it, then question marks began to arise as to whether we were using it appropriately because of the HER2 situation. So we really need to learn that lesson. We can't think that if we just do large enough trials, we can iron out all of the wrinkles of non-molecularly selected aspects to the trials. We really need to be much more focused and much smarter in the future.
Yeah, you know, that Iressa / erlotinib story in lung cancer really was interesting in that there were a bunch of people, still are, who have tremendous responses to these agents that were buried in that 10% or whatever that they were reporting. it kind of has made me look differently as I see new agents being reported and they have these sort of minimal benefits in a randomized study. And then I'm asking people, I'm trying to look for these people who've had great responses. They kind of get buried, I think, in these trials.
I think you've put your finger right on the issue. And I think even as society, I do not believe that we can afford financially to develop drugs in the way we did. I mean, the budget for one of the larger studies, which has started accruing patients around the world looking at a molecular agent, is rumored to be $500 million. Okay? And that's a clever enough study where they're actually looking at good molecular phenotyping. But we don't have the patient resources, the time, or the financial resources, because the downstream effect of doing studies which are so expensive is that the drugs themselves become so expensive. They will be out of reach of societies and their payers if we don't think of a clever and cheaper and more logical and faster way of developing them.
Let's talk a little bit about ER-positive disease, and I'm curious, there's a lot of new strategies being talked about in terms of that. Anything that you are excited about or you think may hold promise for the future?
I think there's an old story that as oncologists get older, they're more inclined to give hormone therapy and more inclined to look quizzically at some of the indications for chemotherapy that they embraced enthusiastically in their youth. I don't know if that's true or not, but certainly, analogously to what we were saying about chemotherapy, I wonder if we are soon maxing out on the benefit we're going to see with classic endocrine therapy. The one thing that would actually give the lie to that is the increasingly recognized interactions between the hormone receptor systems and the more recently described EGFR and other systems. So I think there will be a lot of interplay there. I mean, the truth is we have been giving molecular targeted therapy for many years. But having said that, the one big sort of left hook that hit the oncology community in the jaw this year on the ER-positive patients was the presentation at ASCO in Chicago by Dr. Michael Gnant and colleagues from Austria, who in a population of richly receptor-positive patients in a large, well-conducted 1,800-patient study looked at various combinations of hormone therapy, but with a randomization to get zoledronic acid, Zometa, or not. Now, they have reported a highly statistically significant reduction in the risk of relapse for patients who got Zometa, not just decrease in bone metastasis, but decrease in relapse in general, which supports some other observations which had been made that Zometa, in addition to its classic bone-strengthening activity, might have had an anti-tumor effect. The one, I guess, question that is also striking people about this trial was just how well the whole group did. There was an extremely low rate of relapse for a population of patients who did not have any adjuvant chemotherapy. These were premenopausal patients who were given chemical ovarian ablation with Zoladex and combinations of either tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor.
And there were node-positive patients in that study.
There were a good number of node-positive patients, so it's very striking that the relapse rate was as low as it was.
Which was like 6%,
yes,
I think, overall.
Yes,
amazing, in 5 years.
Yes, that is correct. So that has, I think, caused some people to just say, we really want to see the details of this study. But the observation is a striking one. The people who did it are very fine investigators. And there is another study, of course, which will come out in the next year or two, called the AZURE trial, also looking at possible effect of zoledronic acid in reducing relapse. That is a different study. That is a study which allows patients to get sort of dealer's choice chemotherapy and whatever hormone therapy is indicated depending on your hormone status, and you were then randomized to get Zometa or not.
And ER-positive, ER-negative?
Yes.
Pre- and post-menopausal?
Yes.
So that should expand the issue, although Mike Nant from the Austrian study makes the point that, quote, we made these patients postmenopausal with the LHRH agonist, but that effect really was striking. Of course, there are reimbursement and cost issues involved here, but just based on the science, I mean, in the last couple of weeks, have you been discussing it with your patients?
I have not as yet discussed it with my patients. Certainly, we have launched discussions within our group about the possibility of having a callback policy to advise some patients that they might wish to come in and get Zometa post hoc. Somewhat similarly to what we did when the Herceptin data became available, we quickly got our heads together and compiled a list of all of those folks who had completed chemotherapy over the previous 6 months who were HER2 positive.
Yeah, Peter Radden said a funny thing to me yesterday. He said it was a trastuzumabian-like effect. And I didn't even think about it, but actually 35% reduction in relapse rate is not that much different than what we saw with trastuzumab.
The relative risk reduction here is of the same order of magnitude as was seen with hormone therapy versus none, or for chemotherapy versus none, or for Herceptin versus none. This is a very big effect. I guess, Neil, the big question is, Is that effect somehow in some of these patients a surrogate for a chemotherapy effect? Will we see as big a reduction in patients who also get optimal chemotherapy? I don't know. And it will, of course, inevitably, I'm sure, spawn other studies in which various strategies with or without chemotherapy will be looked at.
And you mentioned the fact that there was a decrease not just in bone mets, but other mets, local recurrence, second breast cancers. And one of the things that's come out about this is the concept that maybe Zometa is not just working in the bone, but in some way is having an effect directly on the tumor cells or implantation of the tumor cells.
These are all the speculations which are being offered. And again, I think watch this space. This is very, very interesting. Again, I'm not in a position to go making a routine recommendation that oncologists in practice should start giving zoledronic acid. And zoledronic acid is a drug which is, while generally safe, not without side effects. Certainly, we and others have reported the occurrence of osteonecrosis of the jaw. That appears to be something which occurs more with prolonged exposure in bigger doses and more intense treatments. The truth is we were probably in the metastatic setting over-treating patients with zoledronic acid in the early years of this really wonderful drug, by the way. I mean, the effect, I often say to my students and residents, I'm old enough to remember when oncology wards always had a number of poor ladies who were dying slow, horrible bone deaths.
Hypercalcemia.
In the absence of visceral metastases. And you just so seldom see that nowadays. They've had a wonderful effect in the treatment of metastatic disease. My own belief, and I said this during the ASCO discussion, is that sometimes the international adjuvant trials movement is like a great big Titanic. It's very hard to make a change course. Even when you know you need to change course, it's sometimes hard to do it. I do believe that we need to have a real serious rethink about the way we conduct the kind of developmental trials that we need to conduct for our patients who are going to be in receipt of molecular treatments. And I believe that it should be a mandate that every single clinical trial which is now done should also contain translational studies.
We did actually a review, it was a little monograph, of the major current breast cancer phase 3 trials that were ongoing right now. We did this as part of a program at San Antonio a couple of years ago, and every single one of those trials had a translational component.
That's great news. I think we are starting to move forward, but, you know,
you don't see that in other tumors, incidentally.
No.
Not as much translational work.
I think it's like the Barack Obama poster, change we can believe in. I think we need to believe in change, but I think we also need to affect the change. I think we're all paying lip service to the need to change the way we do trials, but we need to actually do it. And some of the current generation of trials, I would have to say that I'm just a little bit disappointed that we're still seeing far too much of the vestiges of incrementalism in the design of the trial, by which I mean taking last year's adjuvant treatment and lumping the new molecular treatment on top of it and seeing what happens. I just don't think that's the way we should develop these new agents.